From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, why our belief that the developing world is a mess is wrong.
The story that we ought to be telling is actually for the last 25 years, there has been more progress in fighting poverty and in progress in developing countries than ever before in human history, by a long shot.
Later, film critic Dave Lurson says the new film Lady Bird represents a triumph for coming-of-age films and for its director, Greta Gerwig.
I think that Lady Bird is a great step forward for her. This movie works very well as a compelling, genuine statement, I think, of herself. But I think it has universal meaning. I found myself relating to a number of things.
We'll meet the Milwaukeean behind a funny and often outrageous new web series.
Plus the latest edition of Bubbler Talk and an in-studio performance from Milwaukee native Patty Larkin. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The place of the United States in the global political sphere is tenuous. Foreign aid and the State Department have been in the crosshairs when it comes to cuts to the federal budget.
That could mean significant shifts in the U.S. relationship with the developing world. And Steve Radelet says that would be problematic. Radelet is a professor and director of the Global Human Development Program at Georgetown University. He joined us in the studio recently to talk about the state of the developing world. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've written and spoken a lot on the state of the developing world, and I think you specifically have made the point that what is often the dominant narrative, that the developing world is basically a mess, that narrative is generally wrong. So before we go into how it's wrong, can you share what insight you have into how we got to this point? Why do we think of the developing world the way we so often do?
Well, I think it has to do with the history where for many decades and in some cases centuries, there wasn't a lot going on right back through, of course, the long history of colonialization. But then after the end of colonialization through the period of the Cold War in the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of problems. And in particular, from the mid 70s to the early 90s, most developing countries were in a mess. There was not much economic progress. Of course, there was the debt crisis in Latin America and beyond. Most developing countries were run by dictators, some of them quite nasty. There was violence and war everywhere from Southeast Asia to Central America to Southern Africa around apartheid, and it really was a mess. But that all changed in the early 90s, and what has happened, I think, is people have continued with that older narrative, even though things have quite dramatically changed in the majority of developing countries, not all, but in the majority of them.
At the same time in the early that this was changing in the early 90s, the Cold War was really wrapping up. And you know, there was a time in post-colonial days that the developing world was in a position to or had the reputation of playing the U.S. versus Soviet Union card. Where is the developing world in the geopolitical landscape
today?
Yeah,
so I'm not sure how much it was the developing countries playing the U.S. versus the Soviet Union, or was it the U.S. playing developing countries against the Soviet Union. But there was these relationships where we supported Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines and the Duvaliers in Haiti and Mobutu in Congo and some other pretty nasty people because they were supporting our side in the Cold War. And that changed, of course, beginning in 1989, well, beginning earlier, but really in 1989 and 90 when the wall fell and all of that changed. And so now developing countries do tend to still work closely with the United States and with other countries, but it's not the kind of alignment there was during the Cold War. And many, of course, have good relationships both with the United States and with China. Of course, not so much with Russia. A few in Eastern Europe do. But today it's mostly the United States and China. But it's, the countries are not sort of being forced to choose one or the other, which is a good thing. They're able to work with both the United States and China and other countries. So it's really changed in many ways, and I think in a much more helpful direction.
So what is the story of the developing world that we ought to be telling today?
The story that we ought to be telling is actually for the last 25 years, there has been more progress in fighting poverty and in progress in developing countries than ever before in human history, by a long shot. And it's an enormous amount of progress. In many cases, more progress than we've ever seen in the history of the world. And as we said earlier, most people are are not aware of it. I'll give you a couple of facts here. First, just in terms of extreme poverty. We define extreme poverty today, the World Bank's definition, is a person living under $1.90 a day, which isn't much. They use that unusual number because it happens to be the average that the countries themselves use for the poorest 16 countries in the world. But we define that as the number of people living below $1.90 a day. In 1993, there were 2 billion people around the world that were living under $1.90 a day. Today, that number is down to 700 million. So since 1993, in 25 years, less than that, more than 1.3 billion people have been lifted out of extreme poverty. There's still 700 million people that are left behind, but we have never, ever seen such rapid decline in poverty. About half of that story is China, but it's not only China. It's happening in actually more than 60 countries, developing countries around the world, from China and India, Indonesia, Korea, Malaysia, you know, in Asia, but also in South Africa, Tanzania, Ghana, Senegal, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and many other countries, dozens of countries. So that's on poverty. And I'll just give you one other story, but there are many, which is in health. And I'll talk about child death rates. In 1960, 22% of children born in developing countries died before their fifth birthday, more than one out of five children. Today, that's down from 22% to 5%, so it's one out of 20. And still, 5% is too high, but a drop worldwide from 22% to 5% over the course of several decades, again, is unsurpassed in human history. And more people are living, they're living longer, they're living healthier, they're living outside of poverty, they're living better lives. And that story about the reduction in child death is a story about global cooperation on getting vaccines from private companies to villages in Mongolia and Mozambique that involves the United Nations, which we're celebrating this week. It involves USAID and foreign aid organizations. It involves local clinics. It involves private manufacturers of vaccines. It involves local mothers bringing their children to get vaccinated. It's actually one of the great stories of global integration and global cooperation, and it has saved millions of lives around the world.
If there is a dominant narrative that you would contend is wrong about the state of the developing world, there is also a dominant narrative about the amount that we spend on foreign aid that is likewise also wrong?
Yeah. Most people, there are many, many surveys that are taken that Americans believe that we spend something between 10% and 20% of the federal budget on foreign aid. And in fact, we spend less than 1% of the federal budget. It's a tiny share of our budget that we contribute to fighting poverty and hunger and disease around the world. And so the amount is a mistake. And the other mistake is that people believe that it has no impact, that it doesn't work, that it's not saving lives, and it's not helping with food security and fighting hunger. And it's not the case that every program works. That's true with private sector investments, public sector investments. And there are a lot of cases where things have not gone well. But over the last 20 years, most foreign aid has been quite effective in helping fight disease, reduce hunger, and fight poverty. The story on health in particular, whether it's child death or whether it's fighting HIV/AIDS or fighting malaria, there is actually no question at all that U.S. taxpayers contributing to foreign assistance have saved millions of lives around the world. That is an uncontroversial fact that all Americans can be proud of contributing to.
At the same time, you know, aside from altruistic reasons, what's at stake here? Why is it important for us to be playing this role in the developing world?
Yeah, it's a good question because people, especially these days, tend to think that this is happening in isolation from us. But it's actually, I believe, quite fundamentally important for the United States for a couple of different reasons. One, these improvements in countries around the world in health and in income levels, there's also been a big shift to democracy, which I haven't mentioned yet, are helping to build more capable states and governments that are quite helpful to us. If we want to enhance our own security around the world, we need to be able to work with capable governments and states that can fight against terrorist threats, that can fight against ISIS, that can fight against other groups that are working in northern Africa and along the Sahel. And for our own security, we need strong and capable partners. And as countries develop and come out of poverty and have higher income, they want to work with the United States. They want to work with us. So first reason is for our own national security. But the second, beyond basic security, is also to do things like fight endemic diseases and to fight transnational crime, drug trafficking. Again, we need strong and capable partners that are working with us. Another reason is for markets. As these countries grow, they provide markets for U.S. Medical supply companies and pharmaceuticals and all range of aircraft and automobiles and everything else that people buy. So developing countries are becoming some of the biggest markets in the world. 20 years ago, they were about one-third of global trade. Now they're more than half. So they're providing all kinds of markets. But I think the biggest reason why it's important for the United States is that many of these countries are moving towards more democratic systems and more open economic systems. And they are embracing the very values that the United States has claimed that it has stood for 200 years of fighting for human rights, for openness, for accountability, for people to be able to elect their own governments and hold them accountable, for open economic systems where people are free to choose what they do economically, to be able to send their kids to school. And countries are moving, trying to model themselves on the United States. And I think it is very much in our interests to help support that process so that we have more countries around the world that we can partner with that share our basic values.
So with that in mind, what have you seen in the first, not quite a year, the first 11 months or so of the Trump administration vis-a-vis the developing world?
Well, I'm worried because we are now tend to be taking an approach that when we talk about America first, it sounds an awful lot like America only, where countries around the world are getting the message that the United States doesn't really want to engage with them as much. There's a lot of talk about reducing foreign assistance and the contributions that we make to countries around the world, even programs that are very effective. Of course, there's a lot of talk about reducing trade and building all kinds of barriers, whether it's walls or other kinds of barriers. And I'm hearing from people living around the world how shocked they are and astonished because they have always looked to the United States as a model, as a partner, as someone to work with, and now they're hearing quite a different tone. And I'm worried about that. I'm worried how other countries are reacting. And more countries are looking for other leaders. And I'm hearing more often they're looking to China for leadership. And the Chinese government really is stepping into some of the void on leadership on climate change, on leadership on providing funding for infrastructure. And more countries are saying, you know, maybe the U.S. is moving in a different direction and we need to move more closely to China. So I'm worried about the current direction.
Steve Radelet, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Steve Radelet is a professor and director of the Global Human Development Program at Georgetown University. He was in Milwaukee in October to speak at Marquette University and at the Rotary Club. Our interview with him first aired then.
If you're considering going to see a movie this weekend, contributor Dave Lurson shares his thoughts about one film getting plenty of critical attention. He'll talk about Lady Bird when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWN. More of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. From Rebel Without a Cause to The Breakfast Club to 10 Things I Hate About You, coming-of-age movies have been around almost as long as the film industry has.
Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig's debut as a director, is the latest offering in the genre. The film tells the semi-autobiographical story of Christine Lady Bird McPherson, played by Saoirse Ronan, in her final year of high school in Sacramento, California. Set in the early 2000s, Lady Bird shows how America was changing post-9/11 and how Lady Bird's perspective on her hometown, her family, and her life was changing along with it.
Film critic Dave Lurson joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to discuss Lady Bird and says the film was a great step forward for the writer and director.
This movie works very well as a compelling, genuine statement, I think, of herself, but I think it has universal meaning. I found myself relating to a number of things in the life of the protagonist, the self-proclaimed Lady Bird, as the high school senior protagonist of the film, a girl in a Sacramento high school, a person with creative aspirations who feels that Sacramento is a dead end, the Midwest of California, yes. She memorably calls it at one point. And she dreams of going to New York and doesn't quite know how to do all these things. I mean, I related to her character a lot. She reminded me in certain ways of myself during middle school and high school, where you're trying to invent an identity for yourself in some way. You want to be somewhere else. You're trying to figure out how to get there. There isn't really a roadmap, you know, laid out for you. You have to kind of figure it out on the fly. There's also, you know, money problems. It's not as if you can just, you know, pay your way, or your parents can pay your way to go to Yale or Harvard or some expensive university on the East Coast. Are you going to be stuck with, you know, in her case, Sacramento Technical College or whatever the equivalent would be out there? So she's faced with a great many things, including finding herself, you know, in terms of her emotions, in terms of her sexual exploration. So a lot of things are going on, I mean, for a teenager of that year. I think the movie encapsulates that time of life very well.
Definitely. And Saoirse Ronan, who audiences know from her Oscar-nominated role in Brooklyn, I'm very happy with her performance because too often older people play high schoolers and it just doesn't feel authentic. But
she's,
I mean,
23.
She's 23, so she's closer in age than the typical actor playing a high school student. But her delivery and her pacing just adds a certain spark and fire to this character. While it's also, you know, it's a lot of juxtapositions with her. You know, she wants to be independent and individual, yet she conforms in certain ways, or wants to rush into becoming a woman in various aspects, whether that's academically, personally, sexually, and yet still has a childish-like outlook on a lot of things.
Well, very realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, at no point while watching her did I think this actress is too old for the role she's playing. I had to kind of, you know, check back afterward to see how old she was. Oh, 23. And I remember her from a variety of movies, Grand Hotel Budapest. She's in that one, too. She's actually had a 10-year career in film already. She must have begun at age 13. And maybe she remembers very clearly what it was like to be a teenager. It's not that far away from her.
While the characters are familiar and it's, you know, a story about Lady Bird and her family and the life of a teenager as they're on the precipice of senior year into college, it's not portrayed as a cliche or dull story or characters with all this. You know, there's a new, fresh take on it, which I thought is a great accomplishment for something that's explored so much.
Well, it's a Catholic high school, and even the nuns are not cliche high school teacher nuns that you see over and over again in comedies. All of the characters had a kind of ring of authenticity to them, like whether they were comical people or a little bit, where they were, you know, tragic or some mixture of this. Everyone to me seemed like a real person. The mother character in this movie is kind of interesting because the opening scenes where they're having an argument, the daughter and the mother, in a car on the way back from some, you know, campus tour, naturally some dreary college not too far away from where they live, which is where her mother wants her to go because there isn't any money, and unless you get some great scholarship from somewhere, and you're kind of a mediocre student academically in some ways anyway, so don't dream on about that. They're having this argument, and one would peg the mother then as being a typical sort of grouchy, you know, guilt trip laying on kind of a person who you're not going to like. But as the movie goes on, you find a much broader person, really in many ways a very generous person, evidently. And if there's a structural weakness in the film, it's at least, I don't think it was explained very well. She adopted two biologically unrelated teenagers from difficult home environments. And so, you know, it's an unconventional family in that kind of sense. She's working very hard. The mother is two shifts at the hospital. She has a lot of burdens, and one can really understand the pressures that she is under just as well as one can understand the protagonist, Lady Bird, in this film.
Right, and this movie really touches upon the notes of, okay, we've all rebelled and think we've known what's best for us, but in the end we realize how great our parents are in some cases. And the relationship between the mother and daughter in this movie, probably a lot of people can identify with. You know, there's a lot of aspects someone can personally connect to.
Right. And the father character also, I mean, It's a two-parent, if unconventional, family in some ways. The father is afflicted by the very common problem of fearing job loss, and indeed he is laid off after a while. His company is going through downsizing. The economic precariousness of the lower middle class is something I don't think is being discussed enough, certainly not in Hollywood movies. And one of my, you know, annoyed reactions to a lot of indie films, they all take place in Manhattan on the tree-lined side streets, and everybody seems to have a trust fund. You know, there are, fine, if that's your reality as a filmmaker, we'll go for it then. But, I mean, there's a lot of other kinds of people in America and in the world who should be represented on film. I think that this movie does a great job of showing how not the 1% or the 10%, but maybe how, you know, 50 or 60% of the people in this country actually live.
Yeah, I thought this movie did a great job of kind of giving a little nudge and reminder of all the things that happened. It's set in 2002, 2003 school year, but as you mentioned, it deals with the lower middle class, the fear of being laid off during a recession. It deals with depression, such as the father's character, and her mother works at a psychiatric hospital. So it doesn't shy away from things like that, or coming out, or how friendships change, or exploratory things in your life. It deals with it with a realistic honesty that doesn't, it doesn't shy away from it, but it doesn't stigmatize or shame any aspect of it.
It doesn't stigmatize or shame, and the drama in the movie at times is played with a light enough touch. You don't leave the film feeling depressed, you know, for anybody, really. I mean, it's a very deft touch where you can move people and make an audience aware of the difficulties that realistic characters are having and still leave the theater feeling bright in some way. And I think that Greta Gerwig, the writer-director, accomplished that. I'm looking forward to what she does in the future based on this.
And some of the details I really loved, because it was set in this time frame, everything from the music choices to the little shell necklaces that some of the characters had. Like, it just took me back there instantly. Like, that attention to detail.
Yeah, and fewer handheld devices, I think, was the thing that I noticed.
Yeah.
People were forced more, I think, to talk to each other. You didn't have the phenomenon of people sitting side by side texting each other or whatever. You had to communicate. I wonder if in the future, you know, if society continues to go down this direction, what kind of films we will have based upon people texting each other as a primary means of communication. You know, lettering fill the screen, every frame. I think that would be kind of a boring way of making movies. So I was very happy that we had, you know, a good ensemble cast, really, that again, all of the actors in this film seem to really bring their characters alive with a deep kind of understanding for who they were.
Yeah, it is definitely one of the more accomplished female-led coming-of-age tales compared to the multitude of John Hughes movies in the golden age of coming-out teenage stories. But although it can be classified as a teenage comedy, I'd say it's, you know, more of a dramedy, or, you know, what do you call just a great, honest depiction of something? You know, I think
realism.
It's realism.
Well, realism, because, you know, real life for you know, if in most cases for most people involves humor, right? We hope anyway, involves tragedy, involves disappointment, it involves obstacles that sometimes we overcome and sometimes we don't overcome. So I think that this is realism. I really hate the word dramedy. I mean, it's make-believe kind of words. It's like rom-con for yeah. You know, romantic comedy. Mediocre movie critics coined these things, and I'd rather not use them. But a mixture of drama and comedy, a slice of real life. I mean, I think that's what you have in Lady Bird.
It's gotten 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is
pretty
probably
good.
One of the few.
Yeah.
Has great reviews from us and other film critics. And what words of advice would you have for anyone who's on the fence of seeing this? Because although it is an indie film, I think it could easily hold its own if it was out of the Oriental and in a Marcus cinema.
Well, I hope it expands beyond the Landmarks theater chain and equivalent chains around the country. I think it's a movie that really should deserve some Oscar consideration when the time comes. It's not that far away. right now, maybe especially in light with the disruption going on in Hollywood. I mean, much needed, I suppose, too, with many of the old dogs of the industry being driven out because of their legacy of misconduct going back decades. I'm wondering how this is going to affect the Motion Picture Academy and the various committees that are involved in the nomination process, that maybe this will open some eyes to more movies made by women about the particular situations of women. So this could be not only on the strength of it being a very good movie, but in the context of everything else going on right now, this could be an opening for Lady Bird.
I look forward to seeing what happens. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Larson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express, author of its I Hate Hollywood blog, and a regular Lake Effect contributor. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski about the new film, Lady Bird.
From the big screen to the sometimes very small screen, we'll talk with the creators of a web series with roots in Milwaukee. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Is it everything? More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
No. 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 No.
Is everything okay?
No. 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 No.
Are you okay?
No. 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 No.
What is wrong?
Look at your shirt.
Look at your shirt.
I'm fine. No. No.
And that intriguing scene is from the new web series Low Strung. The satirical and sometimes outrageous series depicts the daily lives of Victoria and Shervin, two best friends living in Chicago.
It was created by and stars Milwaukee native Victoria Lee, along with Shervin Bain, who say they're trying to emphasize diversity and genuine storytelling on the comedy landscape.
Low Strung also tapped into many real-life friendships and connections on and off camera to create a grassroots production. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski sat down with Victoria Lee, Shervin Bain, and co-director and music supervisor Lily Kay. Lee begins by explaining how the series came to be.
Low Strung is a ridiculous web series about me and my best friend Shervin and all of the outrageous situations we get ourselves into on a day-to-day basis in Chicago, but like a surreal version of Chicago.
Yeah, because reality bites, so mix it up.
I like that. So were a lot of the episodes based on something you guys already did together or hypothetical situations that everyone thinks about for themselves or, you know, mm-hmm. and take it times 10?
Definitely a mixture of both, I would say. I mean, we definitely start off with an acid trip on episode one. And from there, we descend into this chaotic scene where it's kind of realistic, but from our point of view. So a lot of things that are happening in the episode are not really there. They're surreal, but they definitely seemed real to us at the time.
The acid trip was real. One thing that caught my attention at the premiere party was that, you know, this was a hobby to realness. Victoria and Lily, you guys used to shoot movies together for the fun of it. So yeah. give me a little bit on that background.
Well, you know, we started making films at the tender age of 11.
Really advanced stuff,
really advanced
too.
Films. We started with a horror trilogy. The first was called Oops, I Peed My Pants. Mm-hmm. Oops, I Did It Again. And Oops, I Peed the Pool.
Yeah. It was a really heavy plot line. It was about a serial killer who was wreaking havoc on us and all of our friends at slumber parties. Oops, I Peed the Pool, we did at your grandparents' pool.
Yeah.
Didn't make any sense. Just like out
I think
control.
I was a killer in the first one. I was like a murdering
you
grandma.
Were, yeah. Oh, yeah. You
I was a murdering grandma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it
so going to
be bonus material?
I hope that we can find it somewhere. I would put that on the internet so fast.
Yeah.
I say that now. It might be terrible and like problematic in some way. Who knows?
Probably very problematic.
But yeah, so we started it as a hobby just for fun. And then when Victoria told me that she had been writing this series, I got really interested in getting more involved and being like behind the camera again and working on directing and things like that. So it's been really fun to make like an adult version of what we've been doing since we were kids.
Right. Mm-hmm. With a little better recording equipment.
Yeah.
Right. Slightly. Well, Victoria, what made you want to sit down and write something like this?
So as my day job, I'm a copywriter, and I mainly write like marketing materials and stuff like that. And one day I was like, you know what? I like this, but I kind of want to test out my writing skills in another medium. And so I was like, oh, script writing would be pretty awesome. And it gave me a chance to like go all the way out there and get really weird with it. And so it was kind of like an outlet for my creativity. And so, yeah, I figured comedy was the best way to do that.
Well, with I suppose this is a question for all of you. Was there a point where it got overwhelming to take this hobby seriously, you know, to get the format of script writing, to realize how much equipment you need, the funds, the startups, the setting up the scene, you know? Was there a point where it's like, oh, okay, we're doing this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was a point in our script writing process where I was like, we've done so much that there's no turning back now, and we kind of have to really commit to this or else this is all going to go to waste. And it's really taught me a lot about patience, because like when I first had the idea, I was like, okay, we're going to write this series on Monday, and then we're going to start filming Friday, and then I'm going to be famous by Sunday, and it's going to be fine. But it's definitely been a long process, but definitely a very rewarding one.
With writing comedy and writing original material, what were you all seeing or not seeing in other web series and TV shows that you wanted to add to the discussion, to the picture?
Definitely just we wanted to be more inclusive. I mean, our day-to-day lives are so mixed with different types of people and people from different backgrounds with different experiences. And a lot of what we see, even when it comes to Black entertainment, is very focused on a very specific type of person. Mm-hmm. And we just wanted to add our voice to the conversation of what people are doing around the world, especially what Black people are doing here in America and the different types of personalities that are out there. So it's just giving our point of view, adding our narrative to an already amazing story that's unfolding.
I saw a really awesome tweet the other day, and it said, let's start calling diversity reality. Mm-hmm. Because that's what it is. It's just reflecting reality. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is so rad. And that's, I think, a big part of what we're doing with the web series is like showing our reality and a lot of people's reality and not just fitting into certain stereotypes that exist within certain genres of like TV and film and everything.
Exactly. Yeah, because you don't really even see like slapstick, which is kind of what Low Strung is, in a lot of Black and brown TV comedies. Even in the comedies, there are like these heavy sort of undertones to them, and there are all these serious points. And we wanted to like go in a different direction and just make something that like you really don't have to think too hard about. It's just silly, you know, and it's weird. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you kind of touch upon serious things with your weirdness, but it's not, the episode isn't totally built around
those
situations.
It's kind of exactly how we live things now. It's we give social undertones, and me and Vic at work might say some kind of slights that are just realistic to the everyday things that we deal with, but we're also not trying to focus on it and hone down on it because we're low strung.
Victoria, you said something at the premiere event that stuck with me. You said that most of this experience was horrifying.
I'm
wondering if you can expand upon that a little bit.
It's just scary to work really hard on something and then, like, show it to the world. Like, that's been the scariest part for me, but in, like, the best way possible. So we premiered it at the Brooklyn Web Fest in New York. And, like, when we first started playing it and I saw it up on a bigger screen for the first time, I would just, like, it started raining on my face. Like, I just started crying, and I was like, this is so scary, and it's perfect and it's beautiful. And I'm like, I don't have this huge acting background or anything. And Shervin and I took classes at Second City and we did all that stuff. But it's still pretty new to us and we're still figuring it out as we go along. So it's definitely scary, but it's definitely very rewarding and gratifying.
Well, certainly, because you ended up taking Best Actress home from that web series.
Queen Victoria.
How was that as a first-time actress?
Queen Victoria. I'm ready for my Academy Award now. No, but it was really weird because I don't know what I'm doing yet. But I didn't expect it at all. Even the nomination, I didn't expect at all. When we got that email, I was like, what?
We were nominated in like 4 categories.
Yeah. And that was one category I did not see coming.
It's crazy.
So, yeah, it was awesome to win that award. I have it sitting up on my dresser at home.
Excellent.
Just look at it.
Wake up in the morning. Just, that's me, Best Actress.
Yeah.
Well, and even though this was both of yours first acting role, you know, in a prolongated series outside of playing around, do you think your dynamic and your already established friendship helped to alleviate any of that intimidation that you might have felt going into it as an inexperienced actor?
Oh, for sure. I think we were definitely playing a lot of parts of ourselves. Some of it was, you know, characterized, but I also think that's kind of how we interact in person. We feed off each other's energy. If we're at the club and we both want to turn up at the same time, we'll jump up on the dance floor at the same time. Or if we're somewhere and everyone else is hype and we just kind of want to sit in the corner and have a convo, we'll do that as well. We kind of feed off each other's energy, and it played the same way in acting out these roles.
Yeah, we've definitely been helping each other through all of this, through writing and acting and filming and everything. It's just been a real team effort, and us helping getting each other through it. So, yeah.
I think what's really cool about even the crew is, like, we're so small. Our whole cast and crew is, like, 6 people, which is so tiny when it comes down to, like, filming and sound and editing and, like, everything. Mm-hmm. And because there's so few of us, and, I mean, the 3 of us were already really close, but even working with, like, Addison and Doug, who I've worked with on music videos before. So, like, there's already that connection. And then bringing all of us together, it's just, like, a very trusting, very close-knit group of people. So it's made it a lot more comfortable. And it's, like, we're not as afraid to, like, mess up, I feel, like we would be if there were, like,
definitely
outsiders involved. Or, you know what I mean?
Especially after that first episode that we filmed, which took about, like, 15 hours in one day where we were up until 6 a.m. filming. We got really close that
night. We got very close.
Well, and this is really kind of a grassroots production.
You know, totally.
The power of collaboration and tapping into resources you already have and keeping it as a small group, does that make it more meaningful for all of you?
I think so.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, collaboration has been such a huge part of this whole thing, especially within Chicago and Milwaukee. You know, we feature music from Chicago and Milwaukee musicians, and it's just been great really finding people who are willing to donate their talent and time to us to pull off something like this.
Yeah.
Well, and going back on the comedy approach for this, you know, when you have to write and shoot a scene or an episode for 15 hours a day and you're trying to hit a joke or a note over and over and over, and it becomes very methodical and it takes the spontaneity of comedy out of the picture in a way that you may find things funny in everyday life. So did this make you question your sense of humor when you're dissecting it and writing it and shooting it over and over?
Yeah. I mean, we definitely changed things based on how they were portraying on film and and based on how things moved as well. I think a lot of it was because we were the writers as well, when we were acting it out, we were able to make those characters different people than who we tried to make them on paper. And everything just still continued to flow well.
And a big part of creating content and shooting a series is the music. And Lily, amongst all the many hats you wore, you're music supervisor for this. And our audiences know you from your musical interviews and performances for us. So what did you want to accomplish with the music selection? Victoria mentioned it's local Chicago, Milwaukee artists. But when it comes to the feel of the episodes, because it kind of spans from every situation.
And I think that was the hardest part, was finding the right moods. You know, I know so many amazingly talented artists here in Milwaukee and in Chicago, and so I wanted to tap as many of those artists as possible to use their music in the series, but it's finding, like, the right fits for different scenes. And so that was, I think, the most fun and also challenging part, because it's, like, tricky to fit the right mood, and that kind of, you know, sways the episode or the scene to go a certain direction. So it was definitely a learning experience. And now we kind of have a feel for the overall vibe and the music of the show just because of kind of figuring it out for the first 4. But I also just really wanted to focus on using, like, Milwaukee and Chicago artists because that's where we're from. And that's really what we wanted to show support of.
Well, and with direction for this, you co-directed with Addison Wright for the series. How is it being more in control of the on-screen content compared to your experience with him doing music videos where you're a part of the scene, but this time you got to step behind that camera and really have a bigger and more focused picture?
It was kind of scary at first because I was kind of, like, not doubting myself necessarily, but I just didn't want to, like, ruin Victoria and Sherman's, like, you know, ideas. But I also, I think through directing, I think it was in episode 2 when I kind of realized, like, wow, I like, kind of took charge and, like, made this scene happen because of the vision I had for it. So it's been a cool experience learning to, like, trust myself and trust my opinions and my ideas. Because when you are doing something brand new, you know, it's kind of scary, like, mm-hmm. to, like, put your name on it or whatever. And I think I mentioned this at the panel. It was really cool to kind of get Addison's, like, stamp of approval when he walked in and I was directing by myself on episode 4. And he was like, oh, this is great. I was like, yeah. Like, it was really cool.
Right now you have 4 episodes out with more to come. But with the work you've shot so far, what was a favorite scene or episode for each of you to pick?
I think all of us love episode 4.
Episode 4, yeah. Lucy Stuhl, psychic Stuhl, scene. Yeah. Definitely one of the more fun ones. We made that whole set. We went to the fabric store, hung up some lights.
In my apartment,
in her apartment. the same room we did acid in. And it was just great to have her come out and, you know, show her support and come in and bring this great energy that we were able to bounce our energy off of and deliver some great lines. Yeah.
Yeah, she showed up at the door and we, like, all started panicking. We were like, it's happening. She's here.
Oh, my God. Because
we're all such big fans of hers. So it was crazy to make that into, like, a working collaboration.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, my God, we love you.
And then touching on directing again, Lily and Addison worked well in lighting that scene. It's one of our more cinematic scenes.
A lot of that was Doug, too. Doug killed
Doug as
that.
Well. Yeah. Doug, our cinematographer.
He's our DP, our cinematographer, like, oh, he's so good.
So good.
Favorite person on set, too.
He's great.
His energy is so cute. He just dances a lot. I love it.
Well, anyone who watches this can clearly see that you're all having fun together. But in the bigger picture, as you mentioned, as you're showing it to strangers, to a wider audience, what's your ultimate goal in producing this web series and continuing it?
I just want people to enjoy watching it and have a fun time watching it. And hopefully a lot of people start watching it and enjoy it. So, yeah, it would be great to get a huge following and kind of build a community around it.
Yeah. Like Vic says, it's great if people are watching it. And I think if they can just see us for who we are, it'll help expand more people out there and just let people see, like, hey, there's other people out there doing different things.
Right.
And we love them all.
And I think it's an easy show to love, honestly.
for
a pretty broad audience, it's just
ridiculous and it's weird and it's just funny and that's it.
Well, we definitely encourage our listeners to check out Low Strung, and I'd like to thank you, Lily, Victoria, and Shervin for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you for having
Thanks.
Us.
Thanks, Audrey.
Victoria Lee and Shervin Bain are the creators, writers, and co-stars of the web series Low Strung. Lily Kay co-directed and is the music director. You can watch all of the episodes of Low Strung from a link at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then be back with the latest edition of Bubbler Talk when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Susan Bentz. A long-ago icon located in Bayview conjured up memories for several listeners, including...
Andy Tyshensky. I'm from the southeast side of Milwaukee. Old Smokey was a train that we saw almost every Sunday when we would go to Grant Park for Sunday picnics. And this was like through the whole decade of the 60s, it seemed. And it always fired up the imagination of times gone by. I've always wondered what happened to it. Where did it go?
Old Smokey was the name given to steam locomotive number 265 after it retired. From roughly 1944 until 1954, it carried load upon load of freight and later folks for the Milwaukee Road. Its official name was the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad. But number 265's career bumped up against progress. Steam engines were out. Diesel was in. In 1956, the retired locomotive jumped to the tracks with a lot of manual labor. The city of Milwaukee replanted it off East Conway Street. Mark Bielzik of Wauwatosa remembers spotting the engine years ago from a nearby restaurant.
I took my then-girlfriend and now wife to eat at Three Brothers back in early 1972. And that's when I saw the engine. So it was a very beautiful engine. And I remember I had a vintage Lionel train set back in the day that had an engine that was almost identical to that one.
I mean, it's somewhere definitely along here. Where it is exactly, I don't know if we can say.
Bobby Tanzillo walks the green space, trying to remember exactly where Old Smoky once stood.
It was placed just west of the Naval Reserve Academy, which is that. Mm-hmm. And they built a spur off the railroad tracks, which were here, to pull it over, and then they took it right back up. They basically did it in a weekend.
Today, Tanzillo writes for On Milwaukee, but he grew up in New York City. Still, he has his own childhood memories of the engine. His grandparents lived here.
We used to visit my grandparents every other summer, and my grandfather would bring us down here to see it.
Interesting tidbit. Right. Okay, a Milwaukee Public Museum artist designed lifelike figures, an engineer and fireman, to watch over Old Smoky.
But then it was only here until about 1975, and I'm not sure why it was taken away, but it went to the Illinois Railway Museum.
About 90 miles southwest of Milwaukee in Union, Illinois. Executive Director Nick Callis likes to think the museum saved Old Smoky.
She sat outside all those years by the lake, you know, right off the lakefront, getting all of that weather. She really needed to get the rust treated and stripped down and painted, and that's what we did.
Old Smoky now comfortably resides in a place of honor, first in line with an especially designed steam locomotive barn. The way Callis sees it, it's the museum's job to preserve its entire fleet for future generations to experience, creating something like Sherry Gresk's cherished memories. Growing up in Cudahy, exploring Old Smoky was one of the special traditions she shared with her dad. Gresk had a special reason for wanting to find out what happened to Old Smoky.
It's like my father watching over and saying, here's your information you wanted. He always called me kid. Here's the information you wanted, kid.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. Do you have a question about the Milwaukee area that you'd like us to explore? Well, if so, submit your question at wuwm.com, and maybe you'll be next to quench your thirst for knowledge.
Finally today, we'll have a chance to listen in on a studio session with one of Milwaukee's most accomplished musicians. Patty Larkin's recording career stretches more than three decades. She's been away from Wisconsin for a long time, but she hasn't forgotten the place where she grew up.
She'll play a concert this evening at Riverside Park to benefit the Urban Ecology Center. Ahead of that, she stopped by the Lake Effect Performance Studio and chatted and shared some music. So before we hear a song, I wanted to talk briefly about what you're doing while you are back in your hometown. You're playing a show to benefit the Urban Ecology Center. What makes them align so closely with what you are about?
I'm associated with a group called the Piggott Hill Trust where I live, and they manage these dune shacks, which was sort of where I wrote a lot of my last album out in the dunes. And they are keepers of the flame that was started sort of by squatters and people like Jack Kerouac and, you know, just kind of crazies and zanies came in. And when the seashore came in, they started tearing down these sort of makeshift shacks, and this group has been able to negotiate with the seashore and preserve them. Now they're historic buildings. But so that, I think, basic, really kind of, you could probably cut that entire answer out, and I could just say, you know, the reason I'm here is because I believe in the Urban Ecology Center. I feel the best when I'm outside and in the wilder edges of the world. And I'm also familiar with it because my nephew and his wife had their wedding reception there a summer or two ago. And
so it's the personal and the universal.
It is the personal and universal, yeah.
Which is kind of what art is about sometimes.
It is. I think that's what you hope for, that something that affects you is able to be translated to a broader sense for people, or resonates with other listeners. And I know for my writing, that's where I come from. I just, you know, I'm the old Hemingway, you know, you have to tell the truth. But also for me, it has to resonate somewhere, even if it's a fictional piece of songwriting.
Well, with that in mind, I gather you've got a song that connects pretty closely to what you're here for.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing the Urban Ecology Center. I'm also here to see my family and also meet my nephews and Mary Joy's little baby, new little baby guy. So this is called The Best of Intentions. It's from Still Green, my last record, and something I wrote after listening to the Nobel Prize winner, what's his name? Bob Dylan for about 8 hours on a drive.
What's his name?
Old what's his name. You know who I'm talking about. Well, the man in the hallway is cleaning up grief, while travelers chase after time like a thief. With oversized bags, they wait for relief in the dawn. The best intentions all get up and leave before long. And the highway is frozen with cold working stiffs who sit in their well heated cars, tightly lipped. Wait for the light to change red to green, then move on. The best of intentions all get up and leave before long. Sooner or later, the good and the bad all end up being just times that you had. Don't take it too hard, thinking you figured it wrong. Well, the sun went away and it ain't coming back. Would be a shame if you forgot how to laugh. Would be a shame turning your back on a song. The best of intentions all get up and leave before long. I told you I loved you, I tried not to cry. Told you the angels all know how to fly. Cross my heart, this ain't goodbye, just so long. Red sky at night is a sailor's delight. So I put on my skates and I'm crossing the ice. Holding my breath.
Patty Larkin recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. She'll play a concert this evening to benefit the Urban Ecology Center. We'll have a longer edition of our in-studio session in the weeks to come. It was engineered by Jason Reavy. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce this show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayan Silver, with production support from Meredith Waters.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz, Rachel Morello, and Aisha Turner. We get web support from Michelle Madernowski, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
For long. Yeah.